The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
As I mentioned, we're coming to you from Aviva Stadium. It's a special show to mark the launch of the 2025 Alzheimer's Memory Walk, which is supported by our show sponsor, Aviva. Alzheimer's Memory Walk is a nationwide event that will take place in about 35 locations on Sunday, the 21st of September, which is also World Alzheimer's Day. You can register on their website, alzheimer.ie. Now, Alistair Campbell, good morning.
Hi, Pat. Nice to see you.
As I drove here, I passed the RDS and I saw your big mug on a billboard outside, writ large.
Well, it's nice coming to Ireland because people seem to quite like... I mean, it wasn't even defaced, Pat. It's been there for a week, apparently. And I was doing an event last night for Santiago Investment, who... And it was really... You talk about... The title was Thriving in Chaos, and you said in your introduction that we're talking about a world in chaos.
Yeah.
And some of the economic data they were giving was pretty alarming. Because of the way that Trump is conducting himself in particular. And then later, and I'm late, I'm back at the RDS today for the tech summit with a data company called Hari. Yeah, as ever, loving to be here. Fabulous venue you picked for your outside broadcast. I love empty stadium. I don't know what it is. I'd love looking at it.
And it's pristine this morning.
It's absolutely beautiful.
It's lovely. Yeah. Now, I thought I'd ask you, you know, the big question. If I cast my mind back a couple of decades, we were, in Europe at least, and in our relations with the United States, we were all pretty good, thank you very much. And then we had, I suppose, you begin with the invasion of Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
Then you followed that with the subsequent invasion 3 years ago in February. Meantime, you have October the 7th and the response of the Israelis and Trump in the White House now. I mean, it is an extraordinarily, potentially explosive mixture of events that have led us from peace to chaos.
Yeah, and I think you've got to go further back. I actually think we're still dealing with the consequences of the global financial crisis. I think that that is what has led to a lot of the populism that has led to Trump, and you mentioned Farage in your introduction, and also Brexit, and the damage that that's done to the UK. But you talk about the relationship with the United States. Every time I come here, and I had dinner last night with Bertie Ahern after the Santiago event, and you can't prove this, but I'm not convinced that the Good Friday Agreement would have happened if we hadn't had a White House that was so committed to making that happen, if we hadn't have had somebody of the patience of Senator George Mitchell. And the one thing you've got to say about Trump is he lacks patience. You know, both Gaza and Ukraine, which you just mentioned there, appear to be going backwards because he's worked out that the easy slogans that he used during the campaign about how he's going to fix it all actually is turning out to be a lot harder. So he seems to be getting bored with both of them. So I think we are. I mean, the title of the event last night was Thriving in Chaos. And, you know, it's hard. But I think, first of all, you do have to accept that we're dealing with forces and pressures and events that, as you say, none of us could have foreseen a couple of decades ago.
But it does seem as if you can fool a lot of the people a lot of the time. I mean, when you look at Brexit, and you campaigned against Brexit, of course, it has been pretty much a disaster, and Starmer is trying to salvage something from the ashes of what was created by Brexit. And yet, Farage seems to prosper. The man who's the architect, if you like, of Brexit.
Well, he was certainly one of them. I think decades of media bias against Europe was a factor. I think David Cameron calling the referendum when I don't think he had to was a factor. Johnson was a big driver of it. Gove was a big driver of it. And Farage, as you say. And what the thing about Farage that I think is interesting, and he is a very, as you say, persistent. He's a very effective communicator. He's a very effective campaigner. But what he's good at is not being properly scrutinized. So, for example, I saw a poll recently that, as you said, he was the main architect of Brexit. Only 11% of people actually put Farage as one of the kind of prime drivers of Brexit. He's moved on. He's now onto net zero. He's onto housing. He's onto different issues. So he flits around. And I think that one of the things I find so frustrating about our media is the way that they let him do it. So like yesterday, he's only got 5 MPs in Parliament. Ed Davey's got dozens, okay? When was the last time that the British media covered an Ed Davey speech live? But there's an attraction to Farage because it plays into this idea of disruption and of the establishment being challenged, even though he is the establishment himself, right? But he represents this sort of Trumpist anti-establishmentism. And I just wish there was more scrutiny put on what he's done, yes, in relation to Brexit, but also into his support for Putin in the past, his relationship with Trump. Look how Carney and Albanese in Canada and Australia, they very successfully exploited the closeness of their opponents to Trump as a driver of support for them. Well, I think, you know, Labour and need to start doing a bit of that with, and I know it's difficult because they're in government, they don't necessarily want to hack off Trump, but at the same time, that's a factor. And then the other thing, so yesterday he said he's going to reverse the winter fuel cuts, the allowance for pensioners, and the cuts to those, and he's going to get rid of the limit that you can only have benefits if you've got up to two children. And how's he going to pay for it? And he says, we're going to stop asylum seekers staying in hotels, and we're going to reverse all these net zero initiatives. Mm. Well, what are the actual consequences of that? But I didn't see him challenged on it.
But there's no numbers given in terms of how...
Of course there isn't.
How would...
Same as Trump didn't give numbers when he was campaigning.
Listening to yourself and Rory Stewart about the Trump effect and how people might get elected...
Would that be on the Rest is Politics podcast?
It would indeed. Yeah. The number one podcast...
in the UK, And doing very well in Ireland too, thank you.
The idea that being pro-Trump is... at the moment, something of a disadvantage. You quoted in Romania, for example, where the pro-Western European candidate in the first round got 20% and then goes on to win it.
Yeah. And I think there is a... I don't think that was just about Trump. I think there was a feeling within the Romanian debate that, they had to stay close to the European Union. But you've got this election in Poland for the president of Poland at the weekend, and that's going to be another one between... the populist, anti-European, pro-Trump hard right, and a more mainstream Tusk-type leader. And look, I think what you're seeing is this kind of... And the right have always been much better organised in terms of this kind of internationalisation of their methods and their campaigns and their talking points and their slogans. I'm always amazed... We were talking before we went on air about Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary. I'm always amazed when I go to America... how much the Republicans talk about Orban. It's a country of 5 million people.
Yeah.
But what they see and what you're seeing now with America, Orban, J.D. Vance is obsessed with Orban. He took on the judges, the media, and academia. Yeah. And what is Trump doing now is taking on the judges, the media, and academia. And what does that do? It erodes the guardrails of democracy.
Going back to the UK and Badenoch and the Tory party, I mean, is that a party that is already dead but doesn't know it? Because you kind of need the Tories to keep, to offer an alternative to Farage in Reform UK.
Well, the Tories are the official opposition, and our system, as you know, is like the government and the official opposition. We've sort of been through this a few times before. I remember when, I think it was when Ian Duncan Smith was leader, and there was just this sort of sense the Tories have done, they can't come back. Tony Blair's, absolutely dominant in the landscape. Labour could be in power for a generation. Now, we were in power for quite a long time, but I can remember Tony saying, the thing you've got to remember about the Conservative Party, they never die, they just sleep from time to time. And I don't know whether this is terminal. I have my doubts. I think a lot depends on how Labour and the Tories react to this reform stuff. I feel that they're reacting to it at the moment by sort of thinking that if they be a bit more like reform, I just don't think that's the way to do it. You've got to attack them. You've got to take apart what they're saying. You've got to expose the damage that they've done in the past and the damage they'll do in the future. But I think Kemi Badenoch, whatever strength she has that got her to be leader, I don't think she's going to be there at the next election.
Mm. Talk to me about collective amnesia in Europe. We were talking about Hungary, and maybe even Poland might end up with a pro-Putin president, and there are other countries as well which have a hankering after something that the Soviet Union used to offer them. And I wonder how they have such short memories of what it was like to live under the Soviet maw.
Well, but it's not only that. We've also got our own collective amnesia across Europe. When you see these people rising up, the very, very, very far right, the kind of, the real hard right Nazi type, neo-Nazis, I mean, where's their memory? So I don't think it's just a kind of Eastern European thing. I think there's a Western European thing going on as well. And I think it's, you're blessed to live in a country, whether for good or bad, I think Irish people do have a sense of their own history. And it informs a lot of your current politics and your current debates. But I think we're back to this thing about the pace of change, about the way that kids are educated. I'm just not convinced that we do have the collective memory that maybe previous generations did. And partly that's the pace of change, and it's the way that we consume media, it's the way we educate. And so I think that, but these are really big historic shifts, and the only way to deal with them, you can't deal with them by sort of tinkering around. You have to engage in the really big argument. I remember John Major, who, when he was Prime Minister, I used to spend most of my time trying to kind of bring him down when I was working with Tony Blair. But I've got a lot of respect for the way he conducts himself in public life now. And he made a speech not long ago, a couple of years ago now, but I ended up sort of partly inspired to write a book about some of the stuff he was saying. And the headline to the speech was, "In Democracy We Trust?" And I think that's the real worry, is that you hear more and more people say, at least the Chinese get stuff done, at least the Putin, you need a strong leader. Young men in particular, I think, are drawn to this sort of anti-democratic, authoritarian type of leadership. And I think that's the kind of thing we've got to watch out for, both in Eastern Europe and Western Europe.
For Europe, the arrival of Friedrich Merz in Germany as Chancellor, and what they have now decided to do, which is, perish the thought, rearm Germany, which would have had terrifying resonances before, doesn't have those resonances now, because it might look as if we have to proceed in Europe without the overarching support of the United States.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. And it was interesting, I mentioned on the podcast this morning about Merz did an interview at the weekend where he was saying as a fact that we, and it wasn't clear whether he specifically mentioned Britain and France and Germany, but whether including the Americans in this, that we, that Ukraine now has no limit on the range of missiles that it's...
He also said that go-ahead had been given several months ago, which intrigued me.
And I think there has been, I think with Scholz, I mean, I was obviously as a kind of left of centre social democrat. If I was German, I'd be a social democrat, as it were. I think Scholz was disappointing as Chancellor. Look, I think Merz is showing a bit of leadership on this. I think Keir Starmer's been showing leadership on this. But the truth is, the talk is all fine. The coalition of the willing thing is all fine. But ultimately, where Trump has a point is that Europe has basically taken American security and American global leadership for granted. And he's basically saying those days are gone. Well, that is giving Europe some pretty big questions to think about.
Now, the other thing that Friedrich Merz said, which I thought was interesting and really game-changing, was when he said enough is enough to Israel. You know, there's no moral justification now for what you're doing in Gaza. And I'm wondering how much of a game-changer that might be, that the country that was terrified of ever criticizing Israel because of the Holocaust is now saying, that's done. You know, we are now in a position where we can overtly criticise not Jewishness, not Judaism, but the state of Israel and its
the current government.
Yeah.
I mean, Angela Merkel, her absolute fundamental pillars of her foreign policy is Europe, closeness to America, and you support Israel, whatever. Okay, that was very kind of part of the German psyche at that time. I think it is very, very significant. I think it's part of our insularity that didn't actually, in the UK certainly, didn't get as much media debate and coverage as it should have done. But I think that it's interesting, when October the 7th happened, and Rory Stewart and I, we discuss what we're going to talk about, we never discuss what we're going to say, we never plan. But that was the one time on October the 7th where we sat down and said, listen, we need to think about how we're going to handle this. And we decided we're going to try to be fair, balanced, tell the history of both sides, mm-hmm. thinking of both sides. And I just think it's got harder and harder and harder. I was watching Channel 4 News the other night. There was this young girl, I don't know if you saw it, escaping from the fire.
This was Lindsay Hilsum's report.
Well, it was the young girl escaping from the fire.
Her sisters had been killed.
Her brothers had been killed. Her mum had been killed. And she literally had tears streaming down her face as she was describing what happened. And now you can say, well, that's been going on for a while. It has been going on for a while. But I think the difference at the moment is that we, the public and leaders, are seeing that. And they're asking themselves, well, hold on a minute. You keep saying you're taking out Hamas.
Mm-hmm. This girl was sleeping on the roof of a school.
Exactly. And not long ago, they were basically saying that their objectives were being met. They now seem to be on a driven by this Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, the hard right in the Israeli cabinet, they've been driven to this place of actually saying, annex the West Bank and essentially, you know, ethnic cleansing of the Gaza Strip.
I don't know whether you saw Ben-Gvir went to the mosque, the most sacred place in Islam. And that is a provocation if ever there was.
Of course it is. And they also had, there was in the same report, I think it was, celebration of Jerusalem Day. Lots of Israelis...
The very hard right.
From the hard right. They were described as being from the hard right, chanting death to the Arabs. And I just think it's got to a place. And I do think, I mean, I hesitate to say this because I think, but I really do think now that it's hard to resist the narrative that Netanyahu is literally all about his own survival. So he can't get rid of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. He's worried about all these different court cases against him, corruption, and the International Criminal Court as well. So he has to stay in power. And the only way he can stay in power is to satisfy this very hard right, Greater Israel, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich.
Now, the argument is, if Hamas handed over all the hostages unilaterally, I mean, you remember the American-Israeli hostage they handed over unilaterally as a gesture towards Donald Trump, but with Trump, eaten bread, instantly forgotten, so I wouldn't pay any mind to that. But that would take away the justification that Netanyahu has for continuing the operation in Gaza. But the smart money says he won't stop, even if he got all the hostages back.
Yeah, and also they don't know what would the impact be, for example, if they returned all the hostages now and X number were already dead, for example.
Which undoubtedly they are.
Right, and what would that then provoke within Israeli public opinion? And you can see, if you're trying to think about it from their perspective, essentially they're saying there is no way you can have any truck with these people, right? But that is the road to nowhere. And I think there is within, I don't know if you watched Louis Theroux's documentary recently about the settlers. It was very interesting because these were settlers who were articulating what Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are driving towards, which is essentially Gaza and the West Bank shouldn't exist in the form that they're in. They're part, they're ours. This is our land. And unless you have, this is why the...
But the demographics are against a united Israel because there'd be more Palestinians than Israelis.
Yeah, but and again, Jews in. I saw a young woman at one of the protests on television saying, we have to kill them to stop them breeding the offspring because the offspring will carry on the cause. And the other thing to say is that it's, you know, and this again is a difficult argument to put forward. And we had this during the troubles here. Is that it's how can you imagine that what these kids are growing up with, kids in Gaza, kids in the West Bank, that what they're growing up with, how can you imagine that it won't radicalize them?
Of course.
I mean, it's sort of, if you're seeing that young girl, right, now it may be that she grows up and she becomes a social worker or a nurse, I'd have no idea. But it's hard to imagine that when you've seen what they're seeing now, and they've seen it now over an extended period of time. Everybody's lost people. Everybody's lost homes. Everybody's been moved around from pillar to post. Are you really going to think, right, okay, for the rest of my life, I'm going to be really, really nice to these guys? It's just not going to happen. Mm. And unless you have leadership, whether that be national leadership, international leadership, then it's hard to see how you fix this.
Mm. I'm just wondering whether we're guilty of, you know, watching an unfolding genocide in the way, you know, people were accused of ignoring the concentration camps, you know, before eventually there was a realization of what was going on. And of course, they were ultimately liberated. But is the world literally watching a genocide and refusing to call it by its name?
Well, a lot of people are calling it by its name. I mean, ultimately, that is a matter, how you define it is a matter for the courts. But that the Ben-Gvirs and the Smotriches speak with genocidal intent, I don't see how you can really dispute that. And I think that, you know, and that's why, back to Trump, you know, when he was with Cyril Ramaphosa, the South African president the other day, and throwing these ridiculous cuttings that weren't even about South Africa and playing a film that wasn't even members of the government and showing these crosses that wasn't even a burial ground. And he's talking about a white genocide. So he's prepared to use the word genocide about a total non-genocide. And yet, when he sat down with
7,000 people murdered in the space of whatever it was, and of those, 59 might have been white, and 9 were farmers.
Yeah,
you know. So what's going on? Come on.
And I think that so then, but when he sits down with Netanyahu, even though he didn't give Netanyahu as much as he wanted, but he's certainly not going to call out the extent of what's going on now. I thought it was interesting that Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister, who is not a friend of Netanyahu's, and we talked to him a while back on the podcast, and he was pretty tough about Netanyahu now, then, but now he is absolutely going for it. He's calling this out.
Alistair Campbell, a world in chaos, that's for sure, but thank you very much for joining us here.
My pleasure.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.